Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
My name is Sia Raj Purohit, and I'm an operator and investor in the EdTech and future of work sectors. I lead the EdTech vertical for AWS Marketplace and also run a VC fund called Pathway Ventures that invests in early stage companies that are changing the landscape for earning, learning, and community building.
Very excited about today's conversation. I think there's a lot of things, a lot of synergies, a lot of mutual kind of stuff that we both are building. So I can't wait to unpack a lot of the things that you're building at AWS and also in your own fund. But before we do that, give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to this.
So I've been working in the EdTech and future work sectors for about 10 years now. Growing up, I was an immigrant. I moved here when I was six with my family. And throughout my 12 years of school, I lived in five different cities and tried the whole gamut of education out. I went to public school, private school, charter school, basically got to experience all of those pieces. But I got really excited about education and the impact that we can have in the space when I was an undergrad. As an undergrad student, I was really struggling with how engineering was being taught. Now it's common knowledge, but the whole one-size-fits-all model really wasn't working for me and a lot of my classmates. So I ended up doing this research project that became a book about America's job skills gap that I published in my second year, 2012, which is the same time that Udacity and Coursera and all of these great companies were coming up in the education sector to fix those same problems that I experienced as a student and as a researcher. So since then, I've been working in the sector, trying to help more people feel less locked out of their career potential. So in my career, I've been early at Udacity and Springboard, and also worked as an investor with GSV Ventures. For the past 2 years, I've been at AWS working on different EdTech problems and trying to help build more solutions in the space. And I also run my VC fund to invest in early stage companies in the sector.
Very diverse background, and appreciate you sharing some of the insights, especially, you know, being a fellow immigrant to this country. I can definitely relate to a lot of the things that you had gone through, you know, professionally and personally. So I can't wait to unpack some of that stuff with you as well. Can you tell us a little bit more about your current role with AWS in EdTech space, and what type of a problem are you solving there at, you know, such a big organization as Amazon?
Absolutely. So Amazon is doing a lot of great things in education right now. My big focus area is on this problem that so much great technology is being built by EdTech companies and founders and builders, but it's not making it into the hands of learners. It's common knowledge now, I guess. The procurement process of buying EdTech tools is so cumbersome that school districts often don't get to engage with the newest technologies, and neither do companies as they upskill their workers. And so the problem I'm trying to help solve with AWS Marketplace is just helping get that technology to learners faster. AWS Marketplace is trying to do for B2B software buying what Amazon.com did for consumer products, making it super easy to find, test, buy, and deploy new types of software solutions. So at AWS, I work with companies like Pluralsight and Coursera in the workforce development space, and with companies like Blackboard and D2L in the K-12 space. And we find avenues to help them get to their end customers more quickly and effectively through AWS's network.
Tell us a little bit about the process of landing that job at AWS. You mentioned you've been there for a couple of years now, and very colorful background from other companies that you've mentioned where you worked before. But going into such a, reputable technology giant as Amazon, I would imagine there was some type of a, transition period. Tell us a little bit about that early stage kind of career when you were applying and trying to get the job at Amazon. Maybe tell us a little bit more about the interview process. Would be curious to get some insight into that.
Absolutely. So I had a little bit of a unique experience joining Amazon, which is that one of my mentors, who has been a long time ed tech executive, is a director at Amazon. And he's like, we're building up this vertical. Do you want to come join? And so that was a really interesting change for me, because I'd always worked at these early stage startups and VC firms, which have like 10, 12, 40 people max. So it was a very big difference to join something like an AWS. But the reason I was so excited is AWS internally often does operate like a startup. It gives the same type of ownership and expects that from people in order to kind of come build whatever that they're working on from zero to one often. So I really like that. I think Amazon's leadership principles, which is how the interview process works to answer your question, like looks for people who have that ability to kind of build, have ownership, dive deep into different types of new areas, and come up with some tangible outcomes. So the Amazon interview process entirely focuses on these 14 leadership principles Amazon has, and asks like different types of candidates to like share stories when they've demonstrated those principles. And I loved that process because I got to share all of I think the Amazon LPs are very similar to how like startup LPs are. And so we're able to kind of relate on that. And that's what I encourage candidates to do as well.
Very interesting. So I can't wait to talk about this a little bit further when we're going to touch upon some of the strategies you currently deploy and advise some of the portfolio companies that you invest in when it comes to recruiting, hiring, and retaining the top talent. But from a standpoint of you also launching your own fund, you have experience working at, you know, a venture capital firm prior to this. Tell us a little bit more about the kind of the story behind this. What was the motivation to build and launch your own venture capital firm? Because, having gone through the fundraise for my own fund, for the Big Sky Capital, I know how challenging and difficult that is. And also, I'm curious about how are you balancing that act, you know, having your own fund and also having a full-time job. Running a fund is it's three full-time jobs of its own. So I'm curious kind of just to get your a little bit of a take into that. So just, I know it's a multiple questions in one, but if you can help us unpack that, that would be interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, building a fund is very much like building a startup. You're wearing so many hats and trying to make it work, like pulling it together, basically. So my story of starting this fund with my friend Taylor Stockton is that Taylor and I both had deep operations experience in this sector. He had also worked at a number of great companies in the space, built a lot of zero to one products. And both of us realized that founders were reaching out to us maybe 6 to 9 months before they were talking to pre-seed and seed funds, because like founders wanted advice from operators before they spoke to VCs. And so they were asking me about my experiences at Udacity or Springboard, and basically how they can help solve some of those problems that they were having in the early stages of their business. So when Taylor and I realized that we were just seeing these like great founders and then introducing them to our friends who were pre-seed and seed investors, we realized that we might as well start making those investments ourselves and become deeper in the journey with these founders. So that's when we started ideating. This was like the fall and winter of 2020. And then in 2021, we launched Pathway with the help of LPs who basically knew us. Like people, like professors actually who had taught us in grad school. One professor had actually introduced me and Taylor, which is amazing. And basically other edtech executives we'd worked with all gave us the first capital. A lot of them are small checks, but honestly, we just wanted to prove out our ability to make those investments and start getting some of the structure in place for the fund. So over the past year, we've made a number of investments in like pre-seed and seed companies and are excited to kind of continue that journey. We see that there's a lot of power in being operator investors because we get to use our day jobs and the insights we learn as we build products to help those founders like be more successful. So it's really cool for me because I get to meet all sorts of edtech companies through the fund and through AWS and basically just help support the entire ecosystem.
The practitioner side is, I can definitely relate to that. And quite a few LPs in our fund are practitioners themselves. And that's what we wanted to focus on, to bring the folks that could definitely be of value to the portfolio companies that we invest in. So what you're talking about, the strategy behind your fund makes a lot of sense, and it's very clear. Tell us a little bit more about the fund, maybe a little bit about the structure of the fund. You mentioned you guys come in early at the seed or pre-seed stages. EdTech seems to be a predominant factor in terms of the vertical you guys play in. Maybe share you know, the types of companies, the types of founders that you guys love to back, any geographical activity that you guys are seeing these days, because VC market these days, you know, have changed tremendously 360 to what it was last year. And I'm curious to get some of your insights. What are you currently seeing in the market? And just share some of those with us.
So the pathway basically focuses on enabling economic mobility. We want to find creative ways to help people earn a better living, learn employable skills, and have the right types of communities to support their professional growth. So we think a lot, again, coming back to my own struggles as an engineering student who was so afraid of not being able to land the types of jobs I wanted because I was not able to understand engineering skills in like a way that made sense to me. Like that feeling of being locked out is what we try to tackle with the products that we support at Pathway. So that is our big area of focus. It is pre-seed and seed, mostly North America, but we're thinking of going more international in the coming years. And the types of founders that we like to work with are the ones who are very like non-traditional in their own education and learning journeys. Both Taylor and I are lifelong learners. We love like people who share that sentiment, who upskill, like start with a different major in life and end up in a different place. Like those kind of people who really think outside of the box of what someone can become because of who they've become is so different from what they had expected themselves. So those are the kinds of non-traditional founders we like working with. And then our key areas of support are basically, we think a lot about like product development, go-to-market, and also building the right teams to help achieve that growth.
Give us a glimpse into some of the initial sessions, initial, you know, meetings that you have with the founders. When you meet them for the very first time, maybe share some of the questions that you love asking them. And more importantly, what do you look for in the responses when you meet the founder for the very first time that really helps you uncover some of the personality and just who they are as a person, who they are as a founder, that really helps you shape some of that decision-making structure, whether that's, you know, a VC-backable opportunity or it's something that's, you know, maybe not the right time for that. So would love to get your insights into that.
So as most pre-seed and seed investors, we focus a lot on this like founding team. And the reason is that they don't typically have the metrics to prove out how big the business can get at that point. So it's basically the team, their vision, like how quickly they work and iterate that determines whether it's a fit for us at that stage. So what I love asking about is basically an every individual story with the education system. And what I love is that like everyone has such a unique perspective when they're building in this kind of mission-oriented sector. They have such a unique perspective on why they care about education. And so I get to hear all of these amazing stories about like people's grandparents, people's parents, or their own education struggles, and what problem they want to solve because of that. So it's, again, very rewarding. I know that in other sectors, people build for other reasons, but in education, mostly you build because there's something that drives you to like try to fix that problem. So I really love hearing those stories, and then also understanding the vision of where they want to take the company. Of course, people who think big are like really inspiring, but also people who start small and iterate quickly to discover that bigger problem are like super unique. So I love when people are like, I started by just asking my friends if they needed this product, and then turns out more people needed it, and then just kind of build up from there. Because that's honestly like how I experienced like building my book, for example. I started sharing notes with my classmates. I'm like, hey, I know you're struggling with engineering school too. Here's what I learned. And over time, it became common enough that many people at the university had my notes. And then I was like, maybe this can become a book for other students to use too. So any great, like I think product or experience starts with just having people who are deeply connected to the problem that you feel connected to. And then that builds a community of potential users or partners.
It seems like you guys have been deploying capital for a short period of time now, I guess about a year or maybe 2 years. Have you had your encounters when it comes to anti-portfolio? Maybe tell us a little bit more about, you know, the unique opportunities where you had an opportunity to invest, but you decided to pass on that. And more importantly, what did you learn from that experience, and how did that impact or shape your investment thesis or investment strategy, if it did?
Very early, so our anti-portfolio is still kind of short. It's going to grow for sure. I think my biggest regret right now as an investor is that our fund wasn't set up in time to participate in OnDeck's early round. The OnDeck fellowship is something I've greatly benefited from and a lot of met so many close friends and collaborators from, and really wanted to make that investment. But setting up a fund in the back end is quite tedious for anyone who's gone through that process. And we just weren't in time for that. So obviously OnDeck has grown a lot. It has evolved a lot. There have been ups and downs for the company, but that's a journey I wish we were a part of as well.
You've mentioned a very important element so that not a lot of people have visibility into just the back office and the overall infrastructure of a venture capital. I can definitely relate to some of the challenges that you talk about, that, you know, the process that we had gone through, that it's, you know, it's a full-time job of its own to set up the infrastructure, the back office of, you know, for a venture capital firm. Tell us a little bit more about that. What are some of the challenges that you guys encountered? Maybe share what type of platform are you guys currently using? What are the advantages or disadvantages? Just a little bit of an insider look for, you know, an outsider view, because not a lot of people actually have that visibility into how a lot of the venture capital firms are set up.
Yeah, so very complex question, because there's so many different options now, which is a good thing. But then the tricky part is that there's a lot of complexity that first-time founders have to navigate in order to identify which option makes most sense. And like early-stage founders, early-stage investors are very frugal because we don't have that much capital to experiment around and play or pay for every deal that we do. So for us, honestly, we started off in a very scrappy way. Like everyone else, we used Notion, Airtable, like those kind of early tools to just start building up our database, start building up the different types of pipeline elements. And then over time, we, of course, investigated AngelList, Carta, Sidecar, Vector, all of the different solutions for building the back office. For the next fund, we're most likely going to go with Sidecar, just because it gives a lot of that flexibility for first-time builders. And but over time, we hope to be able to grow and use some more of these more complex tools, which are much more expensive for early-stage investors.
I got you. Yeah, and I'm very familiar with Sidecar and the founders of that company, which is very impressive what they're building over there. To take this a little bit further, we've talked about your criteria or your strategy when you interview or you meet the founders for the very first time. Maybe from a standpoint of your current role at AWS, and when you hire, members of your team or those that are joining maybe your organization, tell us a little bit more about that interview process, that selection criteria. How's that different from, the process when you talk to the founders? And more importantly, also share What are some of the things that you look for in the responses when you meet the candidates, types of questions you ask, and what really helps you uncover some of those strengths and weaknesses that could potentially impact your decision, whether, to bring that particular person onto your team or not?
Got it. I'll answer this question in a couple of different parts, because hiring obviously at a startup, very different than hiring in big tech, and also very different from Amazon, because Amazon has its own peculiar way of hiring. So I'll answer in all three of those parts. First of all, for a startup, I think that there's this metaphor that people use between an athlete and a surgeon. And I think that piece is really important, because as an early stage startup, you often need athletes, people who can just run, be really good at a range of different skills as the business grows. And over time, as a business matures, you need surgeons, people who are very experienced in the exact problem that you're trying to solve and can come in and go deep in that. So when I joined Springboard, for example, the team was about 15 people. And at that time, most of us were athletes. Basically, we were the high power generalist who could do a range of different types of projects. And that's what Springboard needed at that time. Basically, it was just I joined as a first business hire. So I solved all sorts of problems, such as Which new market do we expand into? Which new vertical do we launch into? And how do we get a new office space, right? Like all of these like range of different types of business problems that like the business team tackles, and just being able to take that nebulous problem and turn it into like a strategy, build some structure and process around it, and actually go execute and move us into a new country or move us into a new office, like all of those kind of things for outcomes. And so when hiring for early stage companies, basically what I look for is like that generalist, high powered, like excited and intense personality. So they're like, I can do any type of work. No job is too small. No job is too big for this, and are able to run with that process. And honestly, I believe that everyone who works in tech should have some like level of experience or have at some point worked at that early stage company, because it really stretches you in such unique ways and takes like all sorts of like these kind of problems that like in people who only work in big tech have never even experienced. So highly recommend that. But the type of personality is, again, high power generalist.
You have a very strong background in edtech, as you've been telling us different examples of your current role and also what you guys invest in from your fund. Tell us a little bit more about the trends that you're seeing in this vertical when it comes to edtech. What are the different new developments, the innovation that happens in this, and how is that shaping how people learn, how people educate? And maybe tell us a little bit some of the research that you do on an ongoing basis to stay ahead of the curve, to see what's really the next wave that coming in that particular space.
So the market obviously is in a tricky position right now, but my belief is that edtech never goes out of style, because we need edtech solutions in every point of like any sort of market journey. So right now our valuations in edtech are taking a correction like they are in general tech, but I think edtech products right now are kind of iterating to figure out how to bridge this new job skills gap, as we have so many people in the market looking for jobs, and how like companies are now hiring. So basically some of the cool products and innovations that we're seeing are one on the learning side. So helping people like navigate the job search by teaching them career ready education, both in terms of the technical skills that they may need to upskill, but also how to interview more effectively, or how to position and solve some of those technical challenges or business challenges that they experience in the interview process. So company I really like is called Interview Kickstart, and they provide like very comprehensive training to get people ready. People have said that it's more cumbersome than a lot of master's degrees to complete, just because of how comprehensive it is. But those kind of platforms vary in demand right now, and there's a whole like scale, like spectrum of them, from like very lightweight through very comprehensive, like an Interview Kickstart. So definitely watching that space, figuring out how to like build tools to help solve that problem of screening candidates as well. Every job posting that's going up now is easily getting 800 to 1,000 candidates. And how can we screen and flag the right candidates for companies is becoming key as well. And then finally, the area that I'm just interested in is about apprenticeships. So thinking about how we can provide like elements of an apprenticeship training model that has been successful in Europe to the US. There's some momentum that's building up in some states like California and Colorado that are enabling apprenticeship models to, and like providing subsidies for companies that enable apprenticeship training. But how can we make that much more mainstream in the US is what I'm curious about.
Pull the thread a little bit further on this. What are your thoughts on just overall the state of higher education? I'm talking about postgraduate degrees and maybe just undergrad in university system here in the United States. I know the, you know, the situation is completely different in other markets, but from, you know, what you're currently observing, you investing, you observe that space very closely. Just what are your personal thoughts on the state of higher education here in the US, and what are the opportunities to improve that space further?
I read a really interesting Twitter thread about this, in which the author wrote about how he believes that platforms or like companies, sorry, like McKinsey and Bain have come up to help upskill early grads, because according to him, he feels that early like college grads just out of university are not actually adding value to the industry. And when I think back like 8-10 years ago, when I was an early grad, I would dispute. I would be like, no, I did add a lot of value as a 22-year-old at that time. But his argument is that these training companies have come up just to make them more employable for that next job. And when I think more broadly about it, that is a big problem. We have so many college grads who are finishing these 4-year programs and still not ready to be in the industry. And I think that's a combination of, like, of course, like the technical skills, quote unquote, but more than anything, it's about like the like softer skills, like the unspoken rules, as they say, are not being taught in universities. And I think that's where the big focus should be for universities. Career centers, like when I was a student and even now, aren't typically used by most students because they feel like there's a disconnect between like what career centers are teaching and what industry really needs. So we need to figure out more innovative ways to kind of bridge that gap and make 22-year-olds much more hireable without having to go to a big tech company or to a consulting firm to gain those skills.
As far as opportunities overseas. The reason I asked that question is because we invest very heavily in emerging markets at Big Sky Capital, and we see a lot of opportunity for immigrant founders or founders overseas that are building unique solutions to very big problems in emerging markets. And then taking that case study of successfully implementing that solution in the local market on a smaller scale and applying that on a global stage and coming, for example, to US. So we see a lot of opportunity there, specifically in Southeast Asia. We have, you know, we have an office in Singapore, in Central Asia as well, where me and my partner, we're from there, from Kazakhstan, and, you know, Latin America as well. So we observe those markets very closely. We talk to a lot of founders in those markets, and it's very interesting what we're observing as far as unique and very nascent opportunities that these guys are solving. Share your personal thoughts on what are you seeing in emerging markets? What are you seeing overseas? What are you seeing on a global scale? You know, just being part of AWS and also as part of your fund, you have a very unique view into a lot of things that are going on a global stage. Curious to get your thoughts on that.
That's a really interesting insight. And yes, we are starting to see the first stage of ed tech companies that originated maybe in India or Southeast Asia expanding more globally. Like, for example, in the workforce development space, UpGrad, which is one of India's largest workforce development companies, is now expanding to the US. So it's interesting to see that. And I think it's something that we're tracking, right? Because the learner profiles are very different and the problems are very different. In India, there's like a very large population of young adults who are looking to upskill and learn from platforms like UpGrad. And in the US, that demographic is slightly different because the element of credentialing and those kind of things vary a lot between the two countries. So curious to see how that expansion happens, but it's just starting. So the results will take a little bit of time to see.
Mm-hmm. Where would you like to take your fund next? Where do you see this going? Where do you see this growing? Are you looking to stay strictly in the edtech space, or do you see you guys expanding from there? Just share some of the vision, you know, short-term and long-term. Where do you see your fund evolving into?
So I see us like, I mean, expanding within the edtech and future work realms, thinking more about like every part of how individuals earn a living. So what I'm super excited to get into in the future, which we haven't invested in yet, is thinking about like ways to monetize from different types of creators, different types of fractional roles that exist, and like thinking about how people can monetize their skills and time in more unique ways. So I really love following those kind of trends and seeing like, of course, like with AI and LLMs, there's just so much more potential to use different elements of time and resources to kind of build new business and monetize in creative ways. So that's what I'm excited for us to expand into. But I do think my life's like work is focused on edtech and workforce development. So it's going to be in this range for sure.
Yep. I couldn't agree more. As they say, the riches are in the niches. So that makes a lot of sense what you're talking about as far as specializing that and really drilling deeper into that space, which will, I definitely see that only growing and expanding from where we're at right now. You're a very accomplished individual from a professional standpoint, the career that you've had, and, you know, being very successful raising your fund. Maybe share an advice or series of advice that you would give to your younger self when you were first starting out, let's say out of college, you're just graduating and you're navigating those very complex waters, which direction to go, knowing what you know now, what would you tell the 20, 21, 22 year old C at the time, based on kind of what you know now? I realize how loaded of a question that is, but talk us through some of the things that come to mind first.
So I think the first thing that comes to mind is about being prepared that setbacks will happen and being okay with them. So when you're 22 finishing undergrad or 26 finishing grad school, like I mean, you're just like, okay, now things are just going to get better and better. It'll be wonderful. But a good manager of mine told me that in every decade, there's going to be one or two down years, inevitably, for everyone. And it's something that I think more young adults should know about. Like, yes, things will not work out. You may not get the dream job you wanted and were perfect fit for, right? Like your company may shut down. Like any of these kind of things may happen. And as my younger siblings are now experiencing as they're 21, 22 right now and entering this job market and realizing that even like FAANG companies pull back like job offers, like anything can basically happen in terms of setbacks. But in during that time, recognizing that first of all, it's not, you're not alone almost. I healed a lot during my setbacks of like not getting those ideal jobs and those kind of things by healing through community. Met a lot of different people. They learned that they all had like different types of setbacks, despite of how successful they were now, and being able to relate with them. And then when you're in the midst of that, like rejection, just being able to put kind of one foot in front of another and be like, okay, well, like see your career as like a series of different like pipelines of opportunities. And you're like, okay, this route didn't work. What else can I do and build to keep moving forward? I think that resilience is super key for anyone to have an interesting career.
I love that advice. And I often try to think of, I mentor and I serve on advisory boards of a lot of different companies. And we always talk about some of the things that you just mentioned when it comes to the setbacks and actually using that as an opportunity to learn from that and improve, that there's no such thing as failure. It's just, you know, a learning opportunity. So thank you for sharing that. Last but not least, what are your most favorite books? Maybe what is the most gifted book that you love sharing with others? And I'll share some of my examples as you think about some of your favorites. The most recent one that I've read is by Dr. Peter Attia, and I'm a big fan. He talks a lot about longevity and just improving overall the mental and physical health. And his latest book is called Outlive. And it's very interesting because he talks a lot about different strategies, how to actually think forward when you're 70, 80, 90 years old. And what are some of the activities that you really want to be able to do when you then and try to work backwards from that so that you can design your current life, your current workout routines, your current diets, and all of that great stuff. So I thought that was a great, great latest read for myself as an example. Share some of your favorites.
That does sound like a really interesting book. I will check that out. It reminds me a lot of the book by an NHP's professor, but How Will You Measure Your Life? I think very important topics. One of my favorite books is Originals by Adam Grant. So in Originals, he basically builds a framework for extraordinary nature and talks about like all of the different elements that go into someone being extraordinary in their field. What I especially liked about this book, honestly, is that he pulled examples from like MLK and George Washington and how a lot, like both of them actually didn't want to become the like icons almost that they've become over time. Initially, like MLK is like, I must focus on my college tenure professor like route, but the community kind of uplifted them into this role just because of the work and experiences that they do. So coming back to, I guess, that advice for the 22-year-old self, if you keep building about something that you're passionate about, there's a chance that you'll connect with the right types of communities that can help elevate you to solve those bigger problems that you aspire for. And I think Adam Grant's book does just a really good example of sharing those stories and frameworks for that.
Great example. And I haven't read it yet. It's definitely on my long list of books that I want to read, but you're not the first person to actually recommend that. So I'm definitely, I'm thankful for that. And just overall, see, I thought it was a very insightful conversation. Very short, but I appreciate your generosity with the information that you had shared. And I'm definitely looking forward to staying in touch with you. And I love doing follow-up recordings with all of my guests where we revisit the conversation from a year ago, let's say, and see everything that we've discussed still makes sense and still applies. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.